As we said, Patricia is going to be speaking on steps 1, 2, and 3, which are, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. So Patricia, we're excited to hear what you have to say.
Hi everybody, my name is Patricia, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, hey,
Kevin, you know what they say about your favorite speaker? Peacock today, feather duster tomorrow. Yeah. My name is Patricia, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Patricia.
My sobriety date is March 13th, 1989. My group is Larchmont, New York, Larchmont is a village 1 mile square outside of New York City. And in our group, we have about 12 or 13 meetings a week, which is a lot for a small area. Yeah. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor women. I'm a little bit odd to be doing this, honestly, because the people that went before me that did this are just so awesome, and I see at least 4 of them here now, and so it's quite a legacy to live up to. Thank you, Kevin, though, for asking me. I do appreciate it. My sobriety has not been neat or linear, but it's been fabulous. I couldn't be here. I know that for sure if I wasn't here. And the reason I'm doing the first 3 steps together, let me back up. Kevin asked me to do this last year, and I was living in New York part-time, living in Erie part-time, back and forth, and I didn't think I had a string of weeks long enough to do it. So I said, when I get a string of weeks, I'll let you know. And so I told him this spring, and then in the meantime, in last November, my husband died. He had a heart attack in the middle of the night. And but I thought, well, I better do it. You know, you've got to keep moving forward. So that's why I'm here. But I did the 3 steps, 1, 2, and 3, together in rehab. And so that's why I'm doing them together today. I think Bill Wilson thought that the first step was really vitally important, because if you look at the big book, the first 60 pages are devoted to step 1 and 2. And then if you add in the Roman numerals, which are 32 of them, that's 92 pages that he has devoted to step 1. So obviously he feels it's really, really vital, as do I. Let me just say one other thing. My last job before I retired in sobriety was I was a college professor. So normally, I would think that I'd have to be up here with PowerPoints and a laser pointer and, you know, learning objectives and all of that. And that isn't how this works, because this is all about how you feel and how your own, you know, your own experience. But it means that I have no sense of how long this is going to take me. So if it takes me too long or too short, I'll straighten it out with you next week. So anyhow, what I'm going to share tonight is my experience with step 1, 2, and 3, which there's nothing that I've invented with step 1, 2, and 3. I got everything that I know from meetings, from my sponsor, from my sponsees, from the big book, from the 12 and 12. But one of the things that I did get very early on, and I got it in rehab, was the progression of this disease. I actually went into rehab not thinking I was an alcoholic. I was very unhappy, very depressed, drinking daily, but thinking that the problems were external to me, you know, had to do with everybody else. And when I got into rehab, I saw the progression, and I thought back on my drinking career when I was in high school. When it was just social drinking, and the drinking was, you know, like fun, 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 fun. We've probably all been there. And then it went to regular drinking, which was weekends and days off. And then pretty soon, by the time I was living in Pittsburgh, which was, let's see, that would have been, I forget the year, I'm very bad with dates. But anyhow, it was regular drinking then. And then when I moved to New York, it was daily drinking. And I was a daily drinker for a number of years before I came into these rooms. I had developed the phenomena of craving, and I just literally drank every day. I don't want to say I was drunk every day, but I literally drank a lot and put myself to sleep with alcohol. So why did I drink? Well, I wanted to be numb. I didn't want to have any feelings that were, you know, departed in any way from absolutely neutral, so I wanted to be numb. So I drank over guilt and shame and all those things. And interestingly, I've come to learn in these rooms that a lot of the things that I felt guilty about were an overreaction, that I didn't need to feel that guilty. But, you know, my thinking was so screwed up. Drinking relaxed me and made me very friendly, which had its good points and its bad points. I always felt like I had, you know, like a drum roll in my belly that I now recognize as anxiety. And if you would have asked me, I would have said, you know, I'm the least anxious person you'll ever know. I was depressed and I was unhappy, particularly the last couple of years before I came into the rooms. Nothing was good enough, nothing was right. I also worked very hard my whole life. And not only did I work hard, but I worked hard to be perfect. And that takes a huge toll on a person when you have to be perfect all the time. And so drinking kind of relieved that a little bit. I also had this internal dialogue that went on in my head. And it was always going so fast. And there was so much speed and so much content going on in my head. It's like if you threw a hammer into my head, the hammer would come flying out. And drinking kind of slowed that down a little bit. The Big Book, and tonight I'm going to use three books. The Big Book, it's 12 and 12, and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, which is absolutely one of my very favorite books. But anyhow, the Big Book talks about, on page 31, some of the methods that we tried. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours. Years before I came in, if I ate lunch at my desk, I would have a sandwich and a beer in a brown paper bag and just close the door, you know. Drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip. I took a lot of trips. I always thought that was a solution, you know. And there was a period of about 10 years when every year we went to a different Caribbean island, and I never saw any of those islands in the afternoon because I would drink so much rum at lunchtime, I would fall asleep, and I wouldn't wake up till it was dark. Swearing off forever, with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise. That actually worked against me. It worked for my denial because I was a big bicyclist. Even the last days of my drinking, it would be not unusual for me to bicycle 10 or 12 miles a day. And so I thought, you know, can't be any problem. Reading inspirational books. I had a book, Why Do I Feel So Bad When I've Done So Well? And my husband used to say to me, I don't understand why you're reading that. Going to health farms. One year I checked myself into Elizabeth Arden in Phoenix, Arizona. It was a spa. And they controlled everything. They controlled your exercise, your food, your time you went to bed, the time you got up. And of course there was no alcohol and there was no carbs. And I lasted 24 hours before I called a taxi and went to a local mall and had brownies and wine. Sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum. So I never really learned I only learned about the powerlessness once I got into rehab and once I was in AA. There's a section where it says, the fact is, see if I can remember this, the fact is that most of us alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our own consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defenses against the first drink. There's really not much debatable about that, and I'm sure everybody can relate to that. I was also, for 22 years, a nurse in the Army Reserves. And so every year, they would send me around to a different base, whether it was Fort Sam Houston, or Fort Meade, or Fort Belvoir, for 2 weeks, and I would have to work. And we had to be on duty at 7. And every day after I got off duty at 4, I would go out, I'd have dinner, and I'd drink. And I'd never get back till like 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning, and then I'd have to be on duty at 7. And you know, in the military, there's no such thing as calling sick or being late. And I'd be so sick, and I'd just drink coffee to just try to get through. And all day long, I'd be saying to myself, tonight, as soon as I get off duty, tonight I'm going to just eat and go to bed at 7 o'clock. And of course, I'd repeat the whole thing over and over and over again. But if you asked me what the problem was, I would have said it was tiredness. I wasn't getting enough sleep. Had nothing to do with the alcohol. So I had really, at that point, lost the power of choice, but I didn't really know it. So really, there's nothing debatable about that. I mean, we could debate how many crazy things I did versus how many crazy things you did when we were drinking, but really, you know, that's just podium flash. The bottom line is that we couldn't drink. The chapter to the agnostics on page 44, which, you know, when I was in rehab, I thought this book was like, you know, here you're paying $28,000 for rehab, and all they do is give you this lousy book. And I didn't get any of the stories, and I didn't get any of the chapters. Now I have my favorite stories, as I'm sure you do too. Anyhow, the chapter of the agnostic is my favorite story, and it talks about the definition of an alcoholic, somewhere here. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Okay. That's not my words, that's the big book's words. If you don't like it, write to New York. Don't talk to me. So, you know, I had all kinds of markers looking back. I was in Lenox Hill Hospital emergency room multiple times with alcoholic poisoning. You know, I passed out in the back seat of cars. I remember one restaurant in New York City that I came out of, and I just collapsed on the curb. You know, and people were stopping, cabs were stopping, asking me, and, you know, it was just horrible. But I discovered step one in rehab when a fellow patient said to me, this was about day 4 or 5, she said to me, you think you're better than us, don't you? And actually, I did. But I knew that it wasn't like socially acceptable to say that. So I said, oh no, I'm not better, I'm just different. And she said, how much do you drink? And I told her. And at that time, I was ordering wine by the Magnum from the liquor store. And when I told her, she just looked at me very nonchalantly and she said, you're an alcoholic. And it was that one alcoholic talking to another that convinced me that I was an alcoholic. That and the fact that I really got the disease concept in rehab. You know, I thought, okay, I didn't ask for this disease, I got it. But now that I know I have it, the onus is on me to do something about it. So those two things really were my step one. I did not see, when you talk about the word unmanageability, that my thinking was off. I only saw that I was drinking. The issue of being unmanageable in my mind came much, much later. I would go into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and I could see where your life was unmanageable, but I couldn't see where mine was. And the unmanageability is a hard thing to figure out. You know, there's no diagnosis for it, there's no MRI, there's no test. What helped me was listening to other people in the rooms and having a good, strong sponsor. And I did, I'll talk about my sponsors later, but I did have a very good, strong sponsor. But some of the manifestations of my thinking were, you know, normal people will think about a problem and they'll think, well, there's step one, step two, step three, step four, and then they put it on the back burner. But not me as an alcoholic. I would think step one, step two, step three, step four, step one, step two, step three, step four. I just couldn't put anything out of my mind, you know. And resentments were big. You know, I would grow them, I would fan them, I would, you know, send them up like mushroom clouds. And it could have been something that happened in 1979 and the person wasn't even around. But, you know, there was the resentment. And I had a huge amount of negative thinking. You know, life was bad, life was only going to get worse. I was constantly living in the wreckage of my future. There was no nothing that was happy or positive. And again, I needed a sponsor to be able to cut into my thinking. So my first real AA meeting was the women's meeting in Larchmont, New York. And I liked all the women right away, but I honestly don't think I wanted what they had. What was more important was that I didn't want what I had, you know. And so that's what propelled me, really. I love Bill D., the third member, his story, the third member of AA in Akron. He was in Akron Hospital. He was a lawyer and a city council member, and he was in Akron Hospital, I think, for like the sixth time in 4 months. He had given the nurses, two nurses, a black eye, and he said before people had wanted to help him, and he resented it, but these folks wanted him to help them. And I kind of got that in AA. I could see that people wanted to help me and they didn't want anything for it. And that was really big for me. And then the 12 and 12 on page 29 says, "But then alcohol began to have its way with us. Finally, when all our scorecards read zero, and we saw that one more strike would put us out of the game forever, we had to look at our lost faith. It was in AA that we rediscovered it, and so can you." Well, the scorecards reading zero was, I was very close to being suicidal. I had made half-hearted attempts a couple of times to take my own life, but it was really just, I was crying for help, and I didn't know what was wrong, and I was depressed. But I really didn't want to die. I just didn't know what else to do. I had thought I had tried everything and there was nothing left. So that moves us on to step two. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore us to sanity. So step one, you know, we surrender, we admit there's a problem. And step two gives us hope. And so the reason I think that the first three steps kind of go together is if I admitted I had a problem and there was no solution, that would be a very difficult spot to be in. So, you know, I've got this problem. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, now I need two because step two gives me hope, and then three moves me along the path. So in my life, the issue of a higher power was very simple. It was me. And I was the oldest of six kids. You know, I would have my mother drive me to the liquor store when I was 16 and go in and get me booze, and she would do it. You know, by the time I was 12, I was working and making my own money, paying for my school clothes, my school books, you know. It's just the way it was in my mind. And actually, being that higher power worked very well for me in the work environment. Because, you know, people are always looking for somebody that's going to jump in and take charge. And it gets you places in your life. I did have a baseline belief in God, but God was like out there somewhere, you know. I didn't disbelieve in him, but, you know, he was just out there. My dad was a very strong Catholic. I remember one time when I was sober, less than a year, he was visiting me in New York, and he came down for breakfast, and right away he started bugging me about something. I don't know what it was. And I said, "God, Dad, you're going to drive me to drink." He put down his fork and his spoon. He went upstairs. And when I went upstairs later, he was on the side of his bed, kneeling down, praying. And I know he was praying his heart out that I not drink, you know, because he had said to me, "I have my daughter back now." I also, my parents, we lived in Erie proper, but when they retired, they moved right out here on Westlake Road. And the first time I went home, they had all this alcohol in their dining room on, you know, all the bottles. They were all dusty, but, you know, it was like an Irish thing to be able to offer people a drink. And before I went home, I said to my dad, "You know, I don't want to drink, so I'd like you to get all that booze out of there before I come home." And when I walked into the house, the whole shelf was cleared off, and there was a statue of the Blessed Mother with a votive candle going. You know, he was, you know, "You go, Dad." So I had this baseline belief in God from my dad, and, you know, I went to OLCS, Kevin. We were there about the same time. I won't say who's older. I went to Villa, I did all the sacraments, you know, but it meant nothing, you know. And the other thing I had a problem with was the word insanity. I really did not like that. That turned me off from this step because I couldn't get it, you know. Particularly, my first career was a nurse, and I was thrown out of nursing school for drinking. And when I got back, the class had rotated to Warren State Mental Hospital. And so I went back to Warren State Mental Hospital with my class. And we would have to take the patients out for walks. You know, we would take like a long rope, and there'd be a student nurse at the front, a student nurse at the back, and the patients would be holding on, and they would all have these big hats because they were on Thorazine and they were sensitive to the sun, and, you know, had this, what they call tardive dyskinesia, you know, the flapping gait. And to me, that was insanity. So how was that in the steps? I couldn't get that, you know. But I could see where it related to alcoholism, you know. It was insane for me to think that I would take one drink. I knew that. I never wanted one drink. If you put one drink in front of me and I said that was all I could have, I would actually get mad because I wanted everyone that was behind it. So I got that as being insane, but I didn't think the rest of my life was insane. I looked around the room, I saw people were sober, I saw they were staying sober, I saw that I was staying sober. The women in AA, as well as God, were my higher power, my sponsor was my higher power. I heard that sanity was soundness of mind, and that made sense to me. I knew that drinking was insane. I knew what it would do to me. And so I kind of made peace with the word insane. But to this day, I really still don't like it. The second part of the second step, believing that the higher power, capital H, capital P, and was God and could restore me to sanity, the beginning of that was in rehab. I was in rehab over Easter, and every night they would take us to the chapel for 20 minutes, and we'd all just sit there. But at that time, on the altar, it was a small chapel, they would have these Easter lilies. You've probably seen them in church, you know. They've got the purple foil or the gold foil and this big long lily. And that was just so moving to me because I thought, here I am, the start of a new life, resurrection, you know, that just all made sense to me at that point. And so I knew that I didn't get into rehab by accident, and I figured God got me in there and he was keeping me sober. And so I was able to come to terms and come to peace with the fact that it was God going to get me sober. Now when I say God direct my thinking, it's because I know there's a God, and I know my thinking is off. So, like the big book said, I took it piecemeal at first. The chapter to the agnostics, huh? Page 46. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. It's interesting, I was talking to my sponsor today. I have, you know, the world's greatest group and the world's best sponsor. My sponsor has about the same time as I do, maybe a year more, and she has terminal metastatic cancer, and she's like been through so much chemo, and you know it's like no more options for her on that. And our group, instead of the celebrant bringing in the cake, once a month we have a group anniversary, and the group brings in a cake, or somebody goes out and buys the cake. Well, who do you think brings in, not the cake, but bakes the cupcakes for that AA anniversary? That's my sponsor. And that's a huge thing for me. And I was talking to her this morning, and we were talking about our concept of God, and she said when she sees a father walking with a little child, holding that child's hand, that's her concept of God. And when she first came in, she was more agnostic than atheist. And certain meetings, she would be afraid, if there were a discussion meeting and the topic was God, she'd be afraid to say anything because she didn't want to say that she didn't really have a God. And so she would just be quiet and pass. And she did that for a number of years until she was able to develop her own concept of God. And she still believes in the great outdoors as her God. And whenever she wants to find God, she goes out in the garden. And I think, you know, I think it's great that this is such a broad highway that everybody can formulate their own concept and just has to keep coming, you know, and you get it. So, step three, I'm right on track with time. Made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. So step one and two are reflection, and step three, now we have to take some action, okay? I did not want to turn my will and life over to anybody. First of all, I didn't trust anybody, and then I didn't think anybody was as smart as me. And then I didn't think anybody had the whole background of the situation, so how could they make an informed decision? Step three in the 12 and 12 kind of describes me. How persistently we claim the right to decide all by ourselves just what we shall think and just how we shall act. Oh, yes. We'll weigh the pros and cons of every problem. We'll listen politely to those who would advise us, but all the decisions are to be ours alone. Nobody is going to meddle with our personal independence in such matters. Besides, we think, there is no one we can surely trust. Well, that was me. But what the motivator was for me was that I was in pain. I knew when I was drinking, I was in horrible pain, and it wasn't external pain. You know, I didn't lose a lot of things. You know, I still had a nice husband, a nice house, a nice car. My pain was all internal, and if you knew me, you probably wouldn't have even known that because it was so well guarded and defended. But what made me decide at first to turn my life over to God was I was tired of being in pain. And just because I stopped drinking, we were talking about this earlier, just because I stopped drinking didn't mean that all that pain went away. In fact, in some cases, it was exacerbated because I didn't have the alcohol to temper it down. don't know if anybody had that experience. So I was willing to try another way, and that was to turn my will over to God. So that was the condition that I arrived at step three with. I really think I partially took step three there in that chapel in rehab, you know, because I wanted to be different, I wanted to be better. I didn't know what that meant, but I knew I didn't want to be the same, and I knew I didn't want to drink. I also knew that being in rehab was serious. I had thought at first it was kind of a lark, but they right away put me in detox, and you know, it was the bed with those metal side rails that came up, and they were taking my blood pressure every 2 hours, and they had me on anti-seizure medicine, and the nurses kept saying, you know, don't get out of bed unless one of us is with you, because the doctor thinks you're going to have seizures. And I was like, at first, whoa. But then I realized, you know, I was a serious drinker. And so that helped me see how, you know, that I had to take this very serious. But basically, it was pain. You know, I was tired of the pain. For me, pain has always been, even in sobriety, a great teacher. You know, I generally don't go to the doctor unless I've had pain and a lot of pain. And, you know, it's just the way it is. But I think back again to Bill Dodson, that third person. You know, he's the guy in the picture with the sitting on the edge of the bed. He's skinny. He's kind of, his shoulders are kind of stooped over. He's got that, I won't say what it's called, that undershirt with no sleeves. And he's talking to Bill and Bob. And that guy was even a deacon in his church, believe it or not. And his previous admissions to Akron Hospital in that year, he had got drunk before he even went home. But they had him get down on his knees right there. They put him in a private room, and they had him get down on his knees and say the third step. And he says, he was there about 5 days. That's Dr. Bob and the good old timers. He was there about 5 days before they could make him say that he couldn't control his drinking and had to leave it up to God. Well, he believed in God, but he wanted to be his own man. They made him, made is in italics, get down on his knees at the side of the bed, right there in the hospital, and pray and say that he would turn his life over to God. And, you know, the day Bill was discharged, which was July 5th, I think, in 1935, that was the first group, because then we went from two guys to three guys. And I'm sure a lot of you, being close to Akron, have visited Dr. Bob's house. It was, to me, when I went upstairs and I saw that bedroom that they called the surrender room, where they would bring the sponsors would bring their sponsees from Cleveland to do their third step. I mean, that just brought tears to my eyes. That was just so moving. So the third step prayer is set on its knees. Why? So that we're making some attempt at being humble. There's a lot of forms of the third step prayer. You know, that's one thing nice about the book. It's not so completely cookie cutter. But the big book on in the chapter How It Works says the third step, and that's the one I took. It says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And of course, like so much in AA, I misread that the first time I took it. I thought God was going to relieve me of the bondage of self so I could be happy, you know. And that wasn't it at all. I was to be relieved of the bondage of self so I could help other people in AA. The big book says that the wording is, of course, quite optional, so long as we express the idea, voicing it without reservation. I sponsor two Jewish women in New York, and when I went to do the third step with them, they say Jews don't get down on their knees. So I said, okay, we'll say it sitting. But for me, where I was, it was like there was this big saber-toothed tiger behind me, or fire-breathing dragon. And ahead of me was the road, but the road was dark. And the saber-toothed tiger was alcohol. And the road ahead was going to be what happened if I turned my will and my life over to care of God. I didn't know what it was going to be. It was dark. I had no idea. But I didn't want to give in to that saber-toothed tiger behind me. So I took the third step prayer. And I've never regretted it. I don't know if anybody ever listens to Earl H. He talks about, for him, it was like being on a roller coaster going up to the top. You know, click, 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 as the roller coaster goes up to the top. And then it kind of stops and slows down, and you're at that point where you have to jump off. And that, for him, was taking the third step. So when I was, I think I had about a year, my sponsor gave me the book, One Day at a Time, and asked me to read it every day. And she said, it was kind of a tradition in our group. She had gotten it from her sponsor, who had gotten it from her sponsor. And so I did. I read it for years. And that book helped me begin to get a stronger relationship with God. And I found it very good. So it was probably the real start of my journey of my higher power with a capital H and a capital P. So I think that's the end. Greg, where are you?
Thank you, Patricia. Well, now we do have some time for some questions. So if you have a question for Patricia, go ahead and raise your hand and I'll bring you the microphone. If you're on Zoom and you can hear me, go ahead and speak up whenever you have the urge to do so. Who wants to get us started?
Thanks, Patricia. Really great. Carolyn, alcoholic.
Hi, Carolyn.
So you shared that you did 1, 2, and 3 in the rehab. Did they have you like write anything out for 1 or take any particular action in 1, 2, and 3? You did share about the prayer, but I just wondered if there was any actual writing or work or talking.
Yeah. You know, it's been so long, and honestly, I was so foggy. You know, for the full first year I was in AA, I could barely read. I could read headlines, but I couldn't retain anything beyond that. I know we did kind of a faux four step, which amounted to basically nothing in rehab, but I don't remember about 1, 2, and 3.
Hi, Patricia. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic.
John.
In your conversation about the step one, and you were in the rehab, do you have any thoughts on how you dealt with denial? You didn't mention the word denial and how it affected you and how you overcame it.
Well, I can tell you my whole family was in denial. My husband drove me to rehab, and they had told me to bring a suitcase with my clothes, and when we pulled into the parking lot, he refused to take my suitcase out because he said they're going to take one look at you and they're not going to think you're an alcoholic. This is how much denial we were all in. I don't think there was a moment in time when I broke through that denial. I think it just kind of seeped in over time. You know, like I said, the other alcoholic talking to me, I saw a movie about the disease process, and you know, it just came in a little bit by little bit. And I'll tell you, even in the first year, there would be thoughts, not obsessions, but thoughts that, gee, maybe I could drink again. You know, I was very scared the first year. I went to meetings every single day because I was really scared. Yeah.
Who else has a question?
Paige, alcoholic.
Hi, Paige.
Did you learn anything about alcoholism as a disease when you were in nursing school? Did they bring anything up about that?
No. It was a disease of the liver. You learned about the manifestations on the liver. Yeah, that's true.
So you had to learn about it in rehab.
Yeah, yeah.
And have you found that many doctors and nurses that you have had to deal with are still fairly ignorant about it?
Yeah, I think that's very true. My husband was a physician. He knew nothing about alcoholism, except that he was living with it every single day. And most physicians don't really. You know, I make a point of telling every doctor I have, every dentist, that I'm a recovering alcoholic. And they kind of chuckle, you know, and they're not really sure. They don't really get it. So it's unfortunate.
Hi, Barb, alcoholic.
Hi, Barb.
I love what you've been doing and saying. It's like I've gotten so much out of what you've just said. But I struggle with this, and people that know me know that I struggle with this, and I'm sure most of us do. But what do you do, besides praying, what do you do when you decide that God's not doing it your way? Because turning your will over to God and then trying to tell God what he should be doing for you is all in one concept sometimes in my mind.
Yeah.
And I get all squirrely. I'm just wondering, well, how do you talk yourself down how do you talk yourself out of that and say, hey, God's will is not necessarily your will or whatever you do? Mm-hmm. How do you approach that?
Well, I think there's two things. Having been around for a little bit of time, I have enough experience to know that what I want isn't always the best for me. And the other thing is, I have a God box, which is just a small box about this big. And there's two things that are in it. One, I'll tell you the truth, my son's baby teeth. And the other thing is, if something is really going a way I don't think it should be going, or that I think I know better than God, I write it down on a piece of paper, I fold it up, and I put it in that God box. And since the day I came in till this day, there's 13 things that I have put in that God box. And all of them have turned out okay. So, you know, that's a powerful thing for me to remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
Mary Alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
Patricia, thank you. Wonderfully done. You sponsor, so how is it that you guide your ladies through these beginning steps? Do you take one by itself, or one, two, and three, or what is your way?
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody's so different, how they come in. And I just try to meet people where they're at. You know, the easy answer would be to say, you know, you have them read the doctor's opinion and the first 8 pages of Bill's story and underline everything they agree with and put a question mark by what they don't agree with, and then you sit down and you go over it with them. But not everybody's able to do that. So, you know, I had one woman who was so anxious, there would be no way I could have any kind of real discussions with her for the first year. You know, I would tell her that her time to call me is between 4 and 6, and she couldn't even do that. You know, she would call all hours of the day, and she was just so anxious. So I don't think there is like a cookie cutter for me anyhow approach. It depends on the person. Mostly a lot of conversation, you know. Your experience, my experience, back and forth. A lot of coffees. Yeah.
Hi, Patricia. My name's Trevor. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Trevor.
Got a little bit of time here, so
okay.
I thought I'd ask another question.
Shoot.
This question is, if you're talking, just say you're talking to a new person, how does it work that, you know, the year that you came in, and the year I came in, and everybody else, you know, lots of other people were coming in as well. A lot of them had the same type of introduction to you know, big book, 12 and 12 meetings, so on and so forth. You're still sober, I'm still sober, and and a lot of us are sober. What made the difference for you to take hold of these this kit of spiritual tools and continue to stay sober?
Well, I think if I had come in and gone to a lot of meetings and read the book and partook of the fellowship, I could have survived. But I would be the person that comes in here and you would have said, how are you? And I would have said, I'm fine. Or, I don't know, some other, you know, non sequitur, I don't know what. But the difference for me was that I saw the people that were doing the best were the people that did the steps. And as I did the steps, I started to feel better and better and better. And so to me, you know, the answer's in the steps, really. I couldn't say that strong enough.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hello, I'm Ryan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ryan.
Patricia, how did ego play a part in steps 1, 2, and 3? Or do you feel like that breakdown was better maybe in steps 4 and 5, you know, freedom from bondage itself, so you could grow closer to God? You know, did that play a part in the denial or helping you to achieve steps 1, 2, and 3?
Did ego play a part in steps 1, 2, and 3? Is that really what you're asking? Yeah. Yeah, it certainly did. I didn't know it. I didn't know that was what it was called. I just thought it was that I knew better than you. And it was my sponsor who, you know, God put this sponsor in my life who was very dogmatic, and she didn't take any nonsense from me, and I was actually afraid of her. And there's very few people I was afraid of. And it was just a perfect marriage because she would cut me off. She wouldn't even let me talk sometimes. Or I'd go to talk to her at a meeting and she'd say things like, you know, I'm here, I want to talk to my friends, you call me later. She was like, so, you know, I started to realize that I didn't have all the answers. So,
thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if that really answers your question,
good.
But.
I think that does it, Carolyn, or Patricia.
Okay.